I would like to mention that one of the advantages that a chairman has is that he can pick out the material for the discussion. And the material that we're going to discuss is covered specifically in two verses. That would be Revelation 7 and verse 8. And on your handout, under verse 7, it should say verse 8, destruction. I think that was omitted. I would like to say that these are my favorite prophetic scriptures, and hopefully the panel will agree with the thoughts that I have in mind, and I won't comment on any of the presentations. We're going to limit it to the panel. Each panel member will receive 5 to 6 minutes. I'll try to time it somehow. And then what we'd like to do is have brief, concise comments by any of the brethren if they want after each question. They have to be brief and concise. And when the brethren are giving their 5 to 6 minute presentations, if I tap on the table, that means they're very close to sum it up in a sentence or two so that we would be able to share all of the thoughts. I know once you get involved in a subject, it's very difficult to cut it short, especially with the short time that we have. So I really did not intend to have like a symposium as such, but just enough time so that each brother would be able to answer each question. And we had this a little while ago, but we were not able to discuss it in detail when we discussed the foreword of the fourth volume. So we're going to cover it more in detail, and also to give an Old Testament setting as to where these scriptures came from. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start out with Arthur Jesuit. And question number one says, give a brief synopsis of Isaiah 47 and any possible antitypical prophetic significance. Brother Arthur.
The 47th chapter of Isaiah kind of gives us an excellent description of the church union existing between Catholicism and the Protestant churches. And that's through the eyes of Isaiah when he was talking to Babylon. The growth, power, and downfall are all spelled out in various scriptures of the Old Testament. We have some in Jeremiah, we have some in Isaiah, we have some in Lamentations. But beginning with the first verse, we notice there is a certain amount of failure and disappointment, so that the prophet Isaiah was admonishing the leaders of the religious movement in Babylon to humble themselves. He could see what was transpiring. And so he wanted them to humble themselves into the dust, acknowledging the fact that they were unable to make success for the entire earth, because that's what they were striving for. And he could read the handwriting on the wall, so to speak. She is referred to, that is Babylon, virgin daughters of Babylon. And in some instances, she was called the lady of the kingdoms. This is said, of course, with a notice as a touch of sarcasm, seeing how long the Catholic Church has had an illicit union, a relationship with civil powers. But also Babylon, considering the babbles of faith, and that babbles is confusion, in their creeds and their dogmas and their contradiction of Scripture, which Isaiah referred to as the Chaldeans. In other words, he was trying to tell them they were no better than the heathen in our 47th chapter there. In fact, they were worse than the heathen. Verses 2 to 3, they tried to, church members back then, and Babylon, they were trying to grind out food for all men. And really, there was not enough to satisfy all the complaints, all the questions, and all the problems that came about. It seemed like back then, fault-finding is the order of the day. The lack of spiritual authority results, we find, in barrenness and ultimate defeat. We recognize from Isaiah that they paid little regard to the aged, to the infirmed, and so on. And so dissatisfaction was all over. Verse 5 touches on the confederacy that there was between church and state because of the past success, the pride, the power, and all this made the whole arrangement fall into evil practices of oppression, injustice, and many evils. And consequently, she is now the, as they Isaiah put it, the daughter of the Chaldeans, no better than the heathen, as we mentioned earlier. Verse 7, she was so confident in her stability and that she does not sense the evils that are upon her. She's oblivious to the fact. I like the way it's put in verses 10 and 11, where it mentions, "For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none see me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it had perverted thee. And thou hast said in thy heart, I am, and there's nobody else beside me. Therefore shall evil come upon thee. Thou shalt not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall fall upon thee. Thou shalt not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know." What these particular two scriptures, 10 and 11, are pointing to is the trust in the perversion of God's word, thinking that no one understands, no one knows like those in Babylon. Actually, the truth message has been an awakening thing for the church in the past and presently. So evil comes upon them, upon those in Babylon, as well as on the churches today, and they don't know where it's coming from, nor are they able to push it aside. No longer can they stand in the multitude of their creeds. They are becoming weary in the multitude of their counsels and by their counselors. And you see various counsels that they've had between the two, Catholicism as well as Protestantism. In the time of strife and need, all this, as the Isaiah puts it, will become stubble, it'll be dried out, and it'll be blown about by the wind. And I like the summation here where it says, there is a way that seemeth right to a group of men, but to the end thereof proveth to be the ways of death. And so our chairman asks, is there any prophetic significance to this 47th chapter? And we feel that it's the breakdown and the collapse of Babylon. There's no chronological numbers in chapter 47. But we find that it had its beginning in 1799 with Napoleon. 1874, the presence was the enlightening process that helped to move this along. 1878, the voice of the Lord was no longer heard in her. 1914, the kings are gone. Also the church and state. Their former relationship is not like it used to be. Since to the present time, many internal problems. I think it's every 2 weeks or so you'll find an article in the paper that shows that the foundation has another crack. And the crack keeps getting wider and wider. And the superstructure is starting to crumble. From the present to the present time, from, let's say, 1914, various changes have taken place, and I think you recognize many of them. The Latin language turned to English. Lately, it's the large gap between teaching and practices. Less and less entering into the priesthood, hence their willingness to accept applicants from a gay community with only the stipulation that they have not engaged in homosexuality for the last 3 years and so on and so forth. Despite the wealth of the Catholic Church, the financial problems multiply because of the millions upon millions of dollars that have been paid out in lawsuits to victims of the pedophile priestly crimes. And recently I noticed school closings, and there's so many little things that you see the superstructure crumbling and crumbling. School closings, we notice, was out of 13,340 schools, 3,100 have already closed their doors because of financial problems. And so we see that all these scriptures that Isaiah was pointing to fit very well into the present systems beginning to crumble, and that's the church and state arrangement.
Thank you, Brother Arthur. I'm glad you covered that very well, because this becomes the basis for Revelation, the 18th chapter. So now we're going to... Oh, first of all, would anyone like to add any thoughts? Yes, Tom, go ahead. Yes, take the mic.
Well, first, I think it's important to know the context of what Isaiah was writing. Yeah. He was writing at the zenith of Babylon's power. And so for him, this was a prediction of literal Babylon's fall. And that's as far as we could take it if the Lord hadn't chosen Babylon as a picture in the book of Revelation. If we didn't have Revelation, we would have to look at Isaiah and Jeremiah and say, well, they're talking about the literal fall of Babylon, nothing spiritual. But the fact that it's picked up so clearly in Revelation, we know that the fall of ancient Babylon is a picture of the fall of nominal spiritual Babylon. And I thought there were some amazing parallels in Isaiah 47 to what we read in Revelation, the 18th chapter. First of all, I think it's also important to say that when we're talking about the fall of Babylon, we're talking about the corruption and fall of a system. We're not criticizing individual Catholics. I know we all know that, but when we talk to people, we have to be real careful that we're not criticizing Catholics. We're criticizing a system that they've come into and that they're being misfed with. And so it's very important to make that clear. But in Isaiah 47, verse 3, it says, "Thy nakedness shall be uncovered." We have the same picture in Revelation 3:17, where she says, "Knoweth not that thou art poor, blind, and naked." She thinks she's clothed with glorious robes, but from God's standpoint, she's spiritually naked. In Isaiah 47:5, it says, "Thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms." Well, that's our verse, Revelation 18:7. "I sit as a queen." She thinks she's queen of the nations, but in reality, she's not. Verse 8, "I will not sit as a widow." In Revelation 18:7, she says, "and that she's no widow." So the parallels are astounding there. In verse 19, "But these two things shall come unto thee in a moment, in one day." And then in Revelation 18, "Her plagues will come in one day." So the parallels are very striking there. We're showing the ties between Isaiah 47 and Revelation 18.
Okay. Very quickly, does anyone else have any comments on what Brother Arthur said? Okay, I thank the two brothers very much for Tom's comments also, because, like Arthur said, we're setting the stage and to show that it has a prophetic significance going into chapter 18. So our next question will be question number 2. Give a brief synopsis of Revelation 18, the starting time and future events. So I know it's going to be hard to contain that in 5 minutes, but... we'll have to have confidence that you could do it.
Well, Revelation 18 is about the fall of Babylon, and Brother Tom made a couple points that I wanted to make also, is that we're not talking about people, we're talking about organizations and systems, and there are many good people in these organizations and systems. Unfortunately, they're going to experience some hard times, but it's because of their association with it that they experience it. If you break down Revelation 18, you can break it down basically into 3 areas. The first 8 verses talk about the actual fall, or the prophetic falling of it. Then you look, the second section is verses 9 through 19, and it's the reaction of the world, the merchants and the businessmen and those who interact with them. And then the last section is verses 20 through 24, where it actually is the destruction of Babylon itself. So in the first 9-8 verses, talking about the fall, we have in verse 2 that we have a strong voice from heaven saying, Babylon, this is the judgment given against it. And then we have a second voice in verse 5. I'm sorry, verse 4. "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people." So the destruction, the pronunciation has been given against Babylon, but God is concerned about the people in Babylon. So he says, come out of her. So the call is out there for those who are truly trying to follow the Lord to separate themselves. And then you have in verses 5 and 6, it talks about what's going to happen to her. She's going to be rewarded double. All the things that she has done is going to come back upon her and more than what she originally dealt out. And as Brother Tom mentioned already, because of her vanity, verses 7 and 8, she says, I am sitting as a queen, I am in control, I am in power, I cannot be touched. That very grounding upon which she is basing her status is going to be removed from her. The second part then is a reaction, and that's in verses 9 again through 19. And that's how the world is going to view it. Not necessarily the individuals, not necessarily governments, but those who interact with her in the sense of making any kind of a profit or merchandise off of her. And according to the prophecy, they're going to step aside. They're not going to be associated with them in this fall. They're going to remove themselves from it and watch it from a distant perspective. And then if we skip down to the last section, starting in verse 20, rejoice over her, thou heaven, ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And then the mighty angel takes up the stone and the destruction comes. And then if you continue in the verse 19, you get the reaction that occurs in heaven based upon this final destruction. So the fall of Babylon is the systems. Revelation 18 goes through those three steps and leads into its final destruction. Now, Brother Art mentioned several dates. So when I looked at this, it's like, well, we think that if you look at the church today, it doesn't seem to be all that powerful, at least from the relationships it has with different governments and businesses and that. So how is it going to come back in the power of favor? And if it's going to come back in the power and favor, when did it lose its power and favor? So if you looked at it from the aspect of losing its power and favor, Brother Art mentioned three dates, 1799, with the imprisonment of the Pope under Napoleon. You've got 1874 with the Lord's return, and then at end of 1914 with the end of the Gentile reign, or the Gentile times. So you have three dates in a very narrow span of time that help limit and control the power of the church. But if she's going to come back in the power and favor so that the merchants and the kings of the earth can step aside from her, what events precipitate this change? Well, we can talk about civil unrest. You can talk about social reform. We can talk about economic pressures. All those. Regarding the civil unrest, you know, we just saw an instance in France where there was a tremendous unrest, and the very natives of that country couldn't even find jobs or work. And we see in our own country where we have, if we have a continuation of the restrictions of constitutional rights based on the terrorism acts that are currently in there, there may come a point in time where the restrictions become too chafing and too restrictive. And so we might see the churches solicited for their help in helping to quell the violence or helping to maintain some semblance of peace and order, because the churches have a greater outreach into the communities than many times the governments do. Regarding economic pressures, you know, currently our government and most governments are having a hard time financing themselves. So if the financial yoke keeps increasing on people, they're going to see that I don't have as much as I'd like to have, and the burden's so great. And they're going to look and see that there are many who are making a lot of money, who have a lot of money, and the government's not feeling that need. And if you look at our own government, we're already taking from those who don't have a voice. We're taking from the budgets of those who are elderly and those who are poor. So the churches might be asked to step in and, again, help find some peace or to even fill in as a stopgap to help cover those areas, the elderly and the poor, or the poor, the elderly and the poor, because the governments cannot do the social funding that they used to provide. Brother Art also mentioned the aspect of the finances and that the church may go bankrupt. Well, with the rising back into power, should it, one of the things that might precipitate its fall is the very fact that it has no finances anymore. And we can already see that there's a lot of litigation that's taking place, and there are different communities that are stepping away from the school systems that they can no longer afford to support them. They're stepping away from their priests. They can't find priests to replace the retiring ones, so their community is dwindling and shrinking. And the money comes from the people and moves up the ladder in that particular system. So if that financing isn't there, then they don't have the power base that they used to have. Another question that we might ask is, what strengths or assets or skills do the churches possess that would allow the governments to ask for their support? You know, how can they come back into power and favor? And, you know, they have basically four things. They have large memberships, they have a social conscience, they have Christian morals, and they have deep pockets at this point in time. So when you start combining some of the financial responsibilities and needs of the society, and you put that on top of a declining morality values, and then just the unrest that can occur because of the different situations and outside and external influences, I can see where the church would be asked to step in and to provide a balancing or a leveling effect on society. Well, so then if she comes back into power and favor, Revelation 18 talks about her judgments and then her destruction. So what might God do to destroy Babylon? Now, it doesn't say. It just says that the judgment's pronounced, and then one day all these things come upon her. We don't have any, to my knowledge, anything that specifically says this event's going to occur, that event's going to occur, and then that's going to cause this to occur. So it could be the fact that the involvement with the governments by the church system, because they're asked, actually backfires on them. And the people that support the church systems realize that the church is more involved and more concerned about their own welfare than their own membership's welfare. And that backlash could cut the feet out, so to speak, of the church systems. They could become involved politically with Israel in this Middle East process and perhaps stake a claim on Jerusalem. And so if that transpires, we could see where there could be a backfire and a backlash against the churches, and so that could precipitate. Okay. All right. One. So, we don't really know exactly what's going to happen to precipitate or fall. We do know that God has made the judgment. We do have some time prophecies, again, the Lord's return, the end of the Gentile times. We can see a lot of things happening with the social and the political arenas. We don't really know what exactly might precipitate it. I don't think we really need to know, but what we do know is that God has pronounced the judgment, that it's going to occur, and there's going to be a reaction to it. And then that's going to lead into Brother George's question a little bit later about the time of trouble and then Jacob's trouble.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Aaron. I think we established the fact that Revelation 18 would occur in 1874, and the brethren both mentioned 1878, that the voice of the bridegroom would not be heard in the nominal system. I think what I may have to do is have the three brothers finish, and if we have any time left over, you could add any comments that you would like. Our next question would be question number 3, would give a brief report on the European unity and the possible uniting of the Protestant and Catholic churches in Europe. Brother Russ.
Thank you, Brother Irwin. The subject of European unity dates back a lot farther than the European Union, which originally was my focus here. You know, there have been notables in history calling for the unification of Europe from way back. Two of the more contemporary ones that sit on opposite sides of the political spectrum were Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler. Both called for the unification of Europe. The unification of Europe is a key consideration in the unification of the churches, because we have seen over the history of Europe that the disunification, the small states of Europe, have kind of been obstacles in Europe becoming any kind of powerhouse on the world scene, especially after the ascendancy of the United States around the time of the French Revolution, or just before the French Revolution. The interesting thing, Brother Art mentioned some of the things that are influencing that are hindering the Catholic Church from asserting its power in the near term as to some of the events taking place in the church. But I'd like to again focus back on the governments of Europe and their position. I'd like to read you one thing to show you the range of opinions that exist in the discussion of unification of Europe. This comes from the Weekend Review, and it says something incredible is occurring across the Atlantic. Old Europe is reunifying into an economic and political powerhouse right before our eyes. And certainly those that, and I'll stop quoting there because of time, but the article goes on to say that the ascendancy of the European Union has done great things for bringing Europe into power. That process started in 1992. In 1995, the EU went from 6 to 15 nations. In 1999, they established the euro as their currency. In 2002, they added another, the euro became the sole currency for another 12 nations. And in 2004, 10 more states entered the EU. So it certainly sounds like a powerful and vital organization. That is one side of the perspective of unification of Europe. The other side, just before I get to that, in the unification of Europe, they have expounded this concept of diversity amongst the European countries. We're all different, but we can all get together. Diversity has been one of the things that they have striven for. But surprisingly, in the founding documents of the European Union, one thing that diversity could not overcome was the mentioning of Christianity being a foundation principle in the founding of so many of the nations of Europe. They felt that the Muslims would be too offended by such a statement, and it was summarily discarded, even though some nations were very much opposed to it, notably the most Christian nations. And this kind of brings into account the other thing that's probably the underlying thing in Europe that's going to cause them the most problems in this unification process is the Muslim issue in Europe. The birth rates in Islamic countries are 2 to 3 times higher than in Europe, and they're more than double that of the Europeans when you talk about the Muslims that have immigrated to Europe. Europeans have basically a zero population growth. Europeans also have a stagnant economy. The typical growth rates in Europe are economic growth rates are about one-tenth of what they are in the United States. So they like this paradigm where the government exercises secular control over the nations. No ties to the churches. That's you especially see that in Europe, in France, where they've made the wearing of any kind of religious symbol illegal. No skull caps for Jews, no crosses for Christians, no other outward signs of religion are tolerated. They have a, quote, secular government. So that's causing them significant problems. But the Muslims are pushing back hard on this, and the immigration rates among Muslims continue to increase. So we see that as a problem in Europe. Notably, in this concept of diversity, the EU uses the Tower of Babel as one of their symbols. They have a painting of it in the halls of their organization. Many tongues, one voice is what they put underneath that. So it's interesting that one of the things the Lord objected to most was they've chosen for their symbol. I think I'll have to skip part of this and just go on to a couple other things. One thing that I think we need to watch as far as the impact in Europe is how this European Union is really progressing. And the most telling thing of that is when it comes down to it, it's one thing to say we like each other, which is the early part of the EU, and we'll use a common currency. That's the second phase. The third phase is this common constitution. And unfortunately, it is failing. Well, I'm not trying to comment on whether or not, but from the standpoint of those in favor of unification of Europe, the Constitution is failing miserably. It passed in the small countries, and it passed in places where the parliament could make the decision. But in the places where it was put to the people, like the Netherlands, like France, it failed miserably. And as a result, other countries like Denmark, Portugal, Poland, and the UK, they have put off their votes on this because the polls are showing that it will also fail there. And if it failed in that many countries, it would almost cause the destruction of the European Union. So when we look at the unification of Europe, we can see both sides of an issue here. But we think the underlying structure of a European Union is probably on the wane and not on the rise. How does this affect our consideration of the influence of the churches on Europe as a whole? It may be different because this Muslim issue could actually argue in favor of that, because it may turn out to be the Muslims versus the non-Muslims. And that puts the churches in a more powerful position than they do, I think, of having direct access to the governments, which was their old mechanism. I think if the Muslims cause a lot of problems in Europe that's the commonality across Europe, is that they're Muslim or they're non-Muslim, that can be a situation where it may make the unification of Europe more feasible, because they review it as a way to control this population of theirs, this immigrant Muslim population that they don't really feel they have a way to control. The recent riots in France were due to some Muslims trying to kind of establish their own country within France, with their own rules and their own laws within this zone. And the French people and the French government kind of knew that that was not a condition that would be favorable amongst the rest of the people. So I would think that when we look to the unification of Europe, a more prominent indicator will not be the state of the European Union, but the state of the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims and the growth of the Muslim community within the European countries.
Thank you, Brother Rust. That certainly was very interesting, and you brought out a different way of looking at it. Very good. Our next speaker will be question number 4, and that would be: contrast the 1,260-year rule of papacy until 1799 and the fulfillment of Revelation 18:7-8 in the future. And hopefully Brother Tom and myself will see eye to eye at this point. Brother Tom.
Well, I think we probably will. Well, verse 7 and 8 do not talk about both future events. Verse 7 is really talking about what she did during the 1260 years. Maybe I should read those two verses. It says, Revelation 18:7, how much she hath glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, I sit as a queen and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judgeth her. The reason that judgment and destruction comes is because of what she did during the 1260 days. If you just take a brief look at the biblical description of what happened during that time period of papal rule, you have to go really back to Daniel, the 7th chapter, is where we first get the clarification of what the 1260 days was. The context in Daniel 7 is talking about the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, and out of that beast comes 10 horns, which were the initial ruling powers that controlled the Western Empire of Rome. The Lombards, the Franks, the Ostrogoths, and so forth. But out of the 10 grew the one horn, and it said that it was to overtake all the other horns. And we can identify the little horn as papacy. Daniel 7:20 says that the little horn had eyes and a mouth that spake great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And then in Daniel 7:25, we're given a further description. It says, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until the time, times, and the dividing of times. Now that's identifying the sins of what papacy committed during the 1260 years, and why Revelation 18 is necessary. It tells us that the little horn would speak blasphemous words against God and make claims that she has no right to make. Of course, we see that in the second volume in the Man of Sin chapter. All the titles that papacy took on for itself were really not appropriate. They were really titles and functions that the Lord himself possessed. And also the times and laws that papacy has changed, that she reigned as a queen, really in a time premature for the reigning of the church. The church, of course, is to reign in the future. But it also identifies a time period of her reign as a time, times, and half a time, 3.5 times or 1260 years, showing us that the reign of papacy's supreme power would be from 539 to 1799, 1260 years. And you get an almost parallel account to this in Revelation, the 13th chapter, and that's why we can be so certain of our identification in the book of Daniel, because Revelation clarifies it. It says in Revelation 13:5, it says, talking about one of the beasts, it's described almost identically to what we read in Daniel, the 7th chapter. Verse 5 says, "There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Now, 42 months is 3.5 years, or again, 1,260 days. So we see the exact same time period that we saw for the little horn in Daniel 7, and we see the same sins being committed. So we know we're talking about the same entity. The sin was to persecute, to wear out the saints, and to overcome them. And one more place, Revelation 12:6, gives us the same identification and the same sins. In verse 6, it says, "The woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath the place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Of course, that's the same period, 1,260 days. And the reason the woman flees into the wilderness is because of the persecuting power of the man-child, who again is a picture of papacy. It shows the beginning of papacy's persecuting power over the church, and that the saints had to flee and be fed elsewhere. So back to the question of contrasting Revelation 18 with the 1,260 years of papal rule. For 1,260 years, she glorified herself. She lived deliciously. She was a queen. She committed adultery with the kings of the earth by ruling with them. She was not the suffering, humble, sacrificial virgin that the Lord was looking for in a bride, but she was persecuting those very ones, persecuting the saints. And because of that, she will be utterly destroyed. And I think looking at Revelation 18, two of the key verses there, verse 4, which I'll come to in a second, and verse 20 is a key verse, because it tells us why she has to be destroyed. It says, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her." Back in Revelation 6:10, it's a picture that's proclaimed during the age, and the saints are saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not avenge the blood of the saints?" 2,000 years go by, or 1,200 years go by, all this persecuting power, and the saints are crying out for vengeance because of the great sins that were done against them. Finally, here in Revelation 18, God's vengeance has finally come on a system that was so corrupt that it would persecute saintly people. So I think that's a key verse. And verse 4, of course, is a key verse. "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues." That tells us two things: that there can be guilt by association, that the people who are associated with a system that's corrupt do, in a sense, in God's eyes, participate in the sins of the system. And secondly, that we have a responsibility to leave because of the judgments of the Lord. And a similar incident is back in Jeremiah, the 8th chapter, where it says the storks know when to migrate, the birds of the air know when to leave because it's fall, but my people know not the judgments of the Lord. And then later in the chapter it says those people are saying, "The summer is ended, the harvest is past, and we are not saved." So the responsibility of understanding prophecy and time prophecy and elements is essential, so we know how to be faithful to the Lord, to understand his judgments, to leave the systems and not to be part of them. So I think that's a key element in making this study practical for us, why we need to know these things. And I'll stop there.
Brother Tom, I have one question for you. If you just take a few minutes to expand on that. We say that Revelation 18 starts with 1874, and the key is that verse 7 is inserted after 1874. So would you have any thoughts on that? In other words, chapter 18 starts out with 1874, so in 18 you're not talking about the past, you're talking about something that could be prophetic in the future. So verse 7 is talking about her sitting as a queen.
I think verse 7 is just reviewing the history. I don't think it's saying that she's necessarily sitting as a queen now. Her queen days are over. I think she will come back to power, but I think that's reviewing the reasons why her destruction has to come. I don't think the entire 18th chapter refers to 1874. I think there's a progression through it. Yeah. I think the destruction at the end, obviously, is still future, so that doesn't fit 1874. But I think there is a progression. There's a review of her past sins, and there's a reaction to her destruction by the kings of the earth, as Brother Aaron said, and then there's a rejoicing over her destruction.
Okay, one more quick question for you. I don't mean to pin you down because I think this is the crucial part of the whole study. Do you see any prophetic significance that in verse 7 she will say this in the future, that what you said, I think all of us agree that that was in the past application of the 1260 days. But do you see any prophetic point in the future that she will repeat and it will be fulfilled that she would say, I sit as a queen and I'm not a widow before her destruction?
I see what you're driving at. Does this show that she'll rise to power again?
Yes.
Probably it indicates that. I don't think that's the point of it. I think she's said this all along, that she sits as a queen, and she hasn't really stopped saying that. But I do think she will come back to power, or an attempt to power. I don't think it'll be the glorious days that she had in the past where she had complete autonomy and rule, but I think it will be a for survival, that she has to do that for her own survival because she sees everything flowing away from her.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to turn to Brother George, and hopefully if there's a few minutes left, the panel could comment on any points that they would like. Brother George has question number 5, and that would be, describe the future events of Armageddon in sequence in regards to the churches, nations, and Jacob's trouble. And Lord bless you, George, for getting this all down.
Well, brethren, here's how we would view the sequence of events that are yet before us. We believe the Protestant and Catholic churches will unite after vitalization of the two horned beasts of Revelation 13. And in harmony with Isaiah 34:4, the heavens will roll together as a scroll. So they're going to unite. The spiritual heavens is what's being referred to. After the churches will unite, we believe they will unite with civil governments, but her reign as a queen will be short. In Revelation 16:13, it says, three unclean spirits like frogs, false doctrines that is, come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and the false prophet. So the dragon is civil government. The beast is papacy, and out of the mouth of the false prophet is the vitalized Protestant Federation. So they unite together. And then it says, and he gathers them together into a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. And we think after this union takes place, I think the truth will be proclaimed in large measure throughout the earth by the true church. It'll be the scriptures will be fulfilled that hail will sweep away the refuge of lies. The people have to come to see what Babylon really is. Her nakedness will be exposed, and it will only be exposed by truth. A sharp sword goes out of our Lord's mouth with which he smites the nations. Again, it's truth from the true church. The smiting of Jordan by Gideon's small band, small group of God's people, will spread the truth throughout the earth. And I really think, as we were talking earlier, the internet will truly make this possible. After the proclamation of truth in large measure, I think will come the persecution of the true church by Babylon. Time will come when none will be able to buy or sell in the spiritual market, as Revelation 13 brings out. Those who worship the beast, who will not worship the beast, will be killed. And then we'll follow the harvest of the true church. The church will be gathered home into the heavenly garner. And then the four winds of Revelation will be let loose, followed by the harvest of the false vine beginning as Babylon is cast into the winepress. There will be an uprising of the people. And as Revelation 17 brings out, it'll be the beast being the common people that supported the harlot riding the beast. And the kings will hate the whore and will overthrow her. Following this, we believe the great company will flee Babylon, coming through great tribulation. They will say in the words of Jeremiah 8:20, they'll recognize the harvest is over. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. Isaiah 66:8 will be fulfilled. For as soon as nominal Zion travails, she brings forth her children. And then will come the destruction, overall destruction of Babylon, as a millstone cast into the sea, as we were talking about earlier in Revelation 18:21, and she will be found no more. Then, after the fall of Babylon, Christendom. We're told the kings, the civil governments, will mourn for Babylon's fall. The kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning. Revelation 18, 9. And then will come Jacob's trouble. Jacob's trouble, we believe, will be the last feature of the Battle of Armageddon. Zechariah 14, 2 and 3, God says, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and it'll look like she'll almost fall. And then we're told in Zechariah 14, 3, but then the Lord shall go forth and fight against those nations as he fought in the day of battle. And following this will come the collapse of all governments and all elements of society, as Zephaniah 3:8 brings out. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. So it will be the destruction of the social structure, all elements of society. Not that the earth itself, we realize, won't be overturned, because then the very next verse, a beautiful verse, after the destruction of Satan's evil empire, God says, and then I will turn to the people a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent. And of course, this will then be followed by the kingdom. The still small voice of Elijah's vision. The mediatorial reign begins, and the first aspect of which mankind will see is the ancient worthies being resurrected and the beginning to teach mankind the new laws of the kingdom.
Thank you, Brother George. All the brethren were very, very well prepared for their separate parts of the symposium here, or panel. And now I'd like to know if anyone would like to add any thought, either from your own segment of presentation, or you'd like to say something in addition to all the points we made. We have maybe about 3 or 4 minutes. Any comments from anyone?
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry for talking so much. Just one real quick one. In Revelation, the 16th chapter, it's talking about the sixth angel pouring out his plague on the river Euphrates and the reaction. Brother George touched on this in verse 13. Three unclean spirits like frog come out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Verse 14, I think, is significant. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole earth to gather to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. I think that indicates that the activity of spiritism will be very much involved in the churches and the church-state union that we expect, that we are to look for increased spiritism and miracles happening. I think we see the beginnings of it now, but according to this, just before the destruction, which is the next plague, right in verse 16 and 17, we're to see an increase of activity along those lines, so we should be aware of that. And that's clear from 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 and 10, where it's talking about the Lord's presence, and it says that Satan would increase his work and activities with powers and signs and lying wonders and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness. So one thing we're to keep our eyes open for is, because of the withdrawing of support, the drying of the Euphrates, Babylon will go to extreme measures in trying to convince people that they are the people of God.
Very good, Brother Tom. And we realize that the pastor suggests that at the very end, before the angels are destroyed, they may have more liberty. So that would harmonize with your thought. Aaron, you have a couple of minutes to offer your thought.
I say that when we look at all the potential things that can happen and what the prophecies prophesy happening, it can be very literally scary, fearful. I just want to share a couple of verses, and that's Psalm 119, verses 165 through 168. And it reads, great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. And then verse 166, Lord, I have hoped for thy salvation and done thy commandments. My soul hath kept thy testimonies, and I love them exceedingly. I have kept thy precepts and thy testimonies, for all my ways are before thee. And if that's the attitude of our heart, then no matter what our experiences are, they're not going to impact us negatively, because the Lord is going to keep us. And then the last verse I'd just like to share is John 14, verses 1 through 3. And it's the Lord Jesus talking to his disciples, and he says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself." So the scriptures are very clear about certain things. There's some interpretation in them. And we know that what impacts the world is going to impact us, our families, our friends, our jobs, potentially. And if we are really trying to serve the Lord, he's going to protect us and keep us in the midst of all the trouble.
Thank you very much. In closing, I'd like to remind the brethren, this is in the author's foreword on page 3. This would be the second paragraph. I will only read two sentences. It says, "But the Bible declares that this reign as a queen will be a short one, and that the fall of Babylon will be tremendous, like a great millstone cast into the sea. It will be during the power of the so-called queen for a little season that the world will be under a great strain as respects any presentation of the truth." And I think that's the main reason why Revelation 18:7 is placed after 1874, because there would be some type of future fulfillment, which will not be on a great scale as the brethren brought out, but it will be a future event. We're going to close now with hymn 196. We're going to sing verses 4 and 5. We'll rise on the fifth stanza, and Brother Tom Ruggiero will lead us in closing prayer.